Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. I'm your host, Amy Wheeler, and today we're going to be talking to Lisa Kaylee Isley, who lives in the Netherlands. And, you know, our topic this month is all about doing a daily practice, letting it transform you, building new neural pathways, new ways of perceiving the world, experiencing who you are, how you fit in, building new neural pathways to plant seeds deep in your psyche and see what grows and sprouts over time, building new ways of thinking and being and speaking and showing up in the world. It all starts with a tiny, tiny little seed in your daily practice. The other thing that we're talking about this month is vairagyam, this ability to kind of let go and surrender after you've planted the seed and you've set your intention and you're doing your practice and you're staying focused. Then you let whatever happens need to happen. And that is a very, very hard thing for many of us to let go of the outcome. So today, as we look at abhyasa and vairagyam, we're looking at it from the perspective of a chanting practice, making sound or mantra, and using that as your daily place that comes back to give you stability, to give you potential safety, a place to settle your nervous system down and dial it down so that you can be at home with yourself for a few minutes a day. Lisa is a wonderful chanting teacher. She's going to walk us through all the reasons we want to try to start it, why it's a good idea, but also looking at some of the obstacles and some of the things that keep us from getting a regular chanting practice. So I'm very happy to introduce you to our guest today, and I think it's going to be a great episode. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. This year, we're going to focus on the 8 limbs of yoga. So let's get started and go meet our guest for today. Welcome, Lisa. How are you? We're so happy you're here.
Welcome to you too. That seemed funny, but I found myself feeling that. I am well, thank you. And I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Lisa, where are you joining us from in the world?
I am in a village in the Netherlands, Wassenaar. It's kind of in the middle of a lovely triangle between Den Haag, which is The Hague, International City of Justice, Leiden, which is the oldest university in the country, old kind of medieval, really cool canal line city, and the beach, which is my life dream, to live within biking distance of a beach. So.
And how far are you from Amsterdam?
A little over an hour.
Okay.
Not bad at all. Easy with a car or a train.
Yeah. And just so the audience knows, you lived in the U.S. for most of your life. Tell us a little bit about your background. Like in Colorado, you were kind of hired at a hospital. And then, you know, we can go on from there. But just so they know a little bit about you.
Sure. So my first career, I think of it that way, my first career, I'm a clinical psychologist. I'm still a clinical psychologist. But my interest was really in understanding the mind. So here I am now in yoga, understanding the mind and people and their feelings and all of that. So it feels like a progression. But at first I found clinical psychology and went to graduate school in undergraduate at Emory in Atlanta, looking at psychology and looking at language development was my honors thesis. Tennessee, my degree in clinical psychology is really psychoanalytic was my original orientation. So depth psychology, really looking at how people develop and how those ways of being are maintained in us. So this topic that we're going to talk about today, really relevant, and how we change those aspects of us that are deep and old and part of who we are. And then I did my internship in Denver, Colorado, absolutely fell in love with Denver, Colorado, went back to Tennessee to finish my dissertation, met my husband, did a little detour through Chicago, Absolutely loved Chicago, where I had a grant through Illinois Masonic Medical Center and Loyola University to do a psychological services in homeless and battered women shelters. So I went around to five homeless and battered women shelters, seeing kids, seeing families, and working with them. Also had a private practice in this really cool practice with this really diverse group of clients. And I was also on the faculty of their internship training program doing supervision. So a nice mix. But I really wanted to go back to Denver. So when my husband graduated from law school, we went back to Denver. And I did a postdoc at the University of Colorado. And that took me to looking at kind of federal government legislation, state level government legislation, and all these different areas of how they oversee mental health services. And then also working in a mental health community center, looking at how they provide for the most vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And out of that, I found my way back to the place, the children's hospital where I had done my internship. So I had been an intern there and they were looking for a training director and they hired me. So I had both the experience of having done that program and then also stepping into it, which was really nice. And over the years that I was there, I became the associate director of the program, and then I became the clinical administrative services director of the whole Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. And then I became the chief of psychology of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. So it was a tough position to leave by the time I left, because one of the wonderful things that happened along the way, I was doing research and clinical work and a lot of community engagement. But we started this program, which I think you're aware of, the Ponzio Creative Arts Program, where we had art, music, dance, and yoga therapists. And so I was a yoga therapist, the first yoga therapist. Then we brought in another colleague, Michelle Fury, and then we grew the program from there. So it was really wonderful because we were doing yoga therapy in all the parts of the hospital. And I designed an 8-week research project based on Jon Kabat-Zinn's model, but I modified it to be for yoga and adolescents. And I actually got the opportunity. I went to the APA, the American Psychological Association conference, and Jon Kabat-Zinn was speaking. I was in this massive room with him. Like, you know, it was packed. People were standing room only. And I just was happy to be there. I was just smiling. And at the end of the talk, this is a long story to tell, but at the end of the talk, I went up to him and he said, "It was so nice to see your smiling face out there." And I thought, oh, good, because I was like, you know, when you're speaking and you're nervous, you like beam like positive energy at people. And so I told him what I was doing and was basically asking for his blessing. And he said, "That sounds fantastic. You know, if I had it to do over again, I would put more yoga in."
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I designed that. I taught it 8 times. And we were doing it with adolescents who had anxiety, depression, and a medical disorder. And we were looking at if we got improvement in anxiety, depression, and somatization, and all three areas improved. So it was a really nice bit of work to get to do. We were also doing groups with the creative arts and psychology. So yeah, it was a really, really vibrant time. But my husband and I, when we got married, had always said we would live in England at some point. And he came to me and he said, "Look, we keep putting this off. When are we going to do it? I don't want to come to the end of our lives and regret not having done this." And then he got a job offer in England and we decided to take it. Wow. So I left my chief of psychology role and I went back to yoga therapy. I was doing yoga therapy, but I hadn't gone through a course myself. I was one of those early adopters because we're talking 2000, 2001, 2, 3, 4. Up to 7. So I lived in London and I flew back and forth to California to study with Gary Craftso and do the American Vinyasa Yoga program for a couple of years. And then just when I finished, there was a program in London, Yoga Campus, and they had partnered with Robin Monroe, who was one of the people who really brought yoga therapy to England, and to run his program. And then he had decided to do research and step out of training, and that program had gone quiet. And so they were going to bring it back and they were forming the new course. And I got invited into a meeting just to be there. And I walked out. I was going to develop the new training clinic. I was going to be a new board member. I was going to be a new supervisor. So then my life, you know, really started to blossom in London. And I was on the board of directors for that training course, increasingly involved for 12, 13 years. And then I left that to move here. So I have a way of sort of starting over in life. But we moved in the pandemic when my husband wanted to start his career over, and that only felt fair. Yeah. So we moved in for him to go to the University of Leiden.
It's so beautiful how you've been willing to follow your dreams and his dreams and weave a life. It feels to me like you weren't just so focused on your career and so identified with it, even though it was very high level, that you were able to step back and say, it's his turn. And now I can go back to school and, really beautiful. And then the other thing that I think is important to this conversation is how high up in the kind of allopathic, more Western medical world you were. And yet, what we're going to talk about today could seem far away from that, but I don't necessarily think it is. So I'm so glad you went through all of that so people could see that although we're going to be talking about using chanting as almost like a mechanism to help shape the autonomic nervous system and the mind and build new neural pathways, it actually can be acceptable to a more Western allopathic person in mind. Like those two things are not exclusive. And I think a lot of times we think, oh, you could never do sound in a medical setting or a behavioral health setting. But anyway, we'll get into all that. So,
Can I say two things about it?
sure.
Yeah, so one thing I felt really grateful for was that the yoga tradition is really one of relationship, right? Where we are in relationship and to our inner guidance and self and also into the outer world. And so I was doing yoga myself in that job. And when we had a new psychiatry head come in, chief of psychiatry, head of department of psychiatry, I was on the search committee. And when we were interviewing her, we found out we both did yoga. And she said, I want to do yoga research and I want you to do it with me. And that just changed my life. And actually, I was doing something already and I thought, I don't know if I want this research life, right? So she came to England, went to England, walked in the stone circles and asked myself, what am I supposed to be doing now? What's the right path for me? And I decided I would give it a chance. And so I came back and so we started doing research together. And because I was ended up the chief, she was the department head, we were treated differently when we brought up the conversation of yoga. But, we had status. So I was the psychology representative for our internal review board for the hospital. And I was bringing my yoga study to the internal review board for the study. And I was on the board of the medical directors. And so, we had a real in. So we could bring things in that I think other people might find harder to bring in. And so we started the first that we know of pediatric integrative medicine program where we were getting referrals and seeing people in that way. And then I left. So there's a way in which I sort of blew that up by leaving and chose my personal life. It was a big deal. But I had also gotten to a bit of a point of burnout in my life, and I needed some time.
Yeah, you can't outrun burnout.
You can't, life can't be and all the time. Yeah. It's not a life I could have as a child predicted I would live, and I'm so grateful for it. Not that
Yeah.
it's always easy, but I kind of like where it's taken me.
Yeah. Well, how do we even begin this conversation about kind of neuroplasticity and building new neural pathways and shaping new habits in our brain with the tool of chanting as the mechanism or as the tool that's going to help us do some of this. Do you want to start us off on that? Because I have a few
Sure.
things I could say, but I'd really love to hear your thoughts.
Well, I'd love to hear yours, so I'll just start and you follow. We had said that we were going to talk about Yoga Sutra 112, which is Abhyasa Vairagya. One of the things I thought, and I wanted to tell you this too. I have so many things to say when I talk to you, Amy, so we'll just,
I'm all
do what
ears.
we need to do. But the way I teach and the way I prepare for things, I get excited about going deeper and learning. That's my motivation to kind of plunge in. So last night I was rereading, of course, the sutras right before bed. And this morning I was thinking through all of these things. And then I started writing some things. And I was just going to thank you for the conversation you and I had before we even got on air in my own head. Because, really reflecting on these things. And I was thinking that there are a lot of people listening who know this sutra. Of all the sutras, some of them people really know, and this is one of them, because it's one of the linchpins of the whole thing. And I think we can take it in all kind of directions. But one of the pieces is we do something that we call practice, for a sustained period of time so that it becomes stable and sustainable in us, right? And that we stick with it. It doesn't look the same every day. It isn't the same across the years. You and I have been practicing for many, many, many years. But there's something that we love that we come back to. And I've begun to think of Abhyasa. I've been reading a lot about attachment theory again and this need for a secure base. And I think Abhyasa becomes our secure base. It's our place that we come back to, that we build a secure base in ourselves. Like, I trust myself. I have something. I can come back to this. So Abhyasa is whatever the tool's going to be. It's the vehicle whereby I make a commitment to this, to myself, to my own well-being, to my own growing, to my own development. I'm going to use these tools and I'm going to stick with this across my life. Right? So I think of that as one way to think of Abhyasa. And Vairagya is the fact that everything that comes goes. And that some of what we need to do in order to change is let go of old limiting beliefs, old false impressions, old painful things that still hold on to us in the present, like we were still in the past. So we need a mechanism not only for what we hold on to, which I've learned to think of as Samyoga, the things we hold on to and move toward. We also need the letting go end of it, the Viyoga. And that's the Vairagya. Like, how do we discern the difference? What do I need to keep? What do I need to let go? How do I operationalize this process also of letting go? And one thing to let go of is I can't chant in this setting. I can't chant in that setting. And to realize, oh, let me try it. You know what? It may be okay. And so it's this whole idea, I think, of how we meet something where we realize in breath, something's coming in, out breath, something's going out. And we come to terms with whatever that thing is through this way of understanding it.
Yeah. I mean, need we say any more than that? To have a consistent place we can come home to. It's free. It's low risk. It's something you can do anywhere. You can chant silently. Chanting, you can make sound. I mean, there's so many reasons why it works, right? And I love this idea about doing this, committing to this practice is the stabilizing thing that when the world is going crazy around us, we can come back and I'm going to sit down for 10 minutes and do my chant and it's going to help me get stable again.
Absolutely. But one of the things that always motivates me is I have this, I don't know if it's a past life or what, but I have this fear of being, not just in enclosed spaces, I don't mind enclosed spaces, I have a fear of being like in jail or locked up or somewhere where I can't get out. And I think, what could I do if everything else was taken away? And the answer is breath and chanting.
And I think that's too, Lisa. I've always thought, am I a weirdo? I always think, okay, if I got put in prison, I'm in the perfect place. I would know what to do with my 12 hours a day, you know?
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So it was very interesting. My go-to on the sutras is this Panditji, Pandit Rajmani Tegonai at the Himalayan Institute. So one of my Abhyasas is that I've been studying with the same teachers for decades. So I feel really anchored in a tradition. I go deep in it. I do something with them every year, if not more than one thing every year. I also sample around because I want to see what else is there. You know, what else I can learn, how else I can see this more clearly if I counterpose it with another perspective. But I turned to Panditji and I reread the sutras and I was pulling out, you know, sort of that integrative function, like, what do I get from this? And I was thinking, okay, so in our tradition and in this text, what are the two methods for how do we deal with the problems in our mind? Because there's two things, there's two bits of guidance, I think, when I look at the Yoga Sutras. One is let go of some stuff that's struggling you and move toward this sutra, move toward the things that are good for you. And then I had originally talked to you about Pratipaksha Bhavana, which is how we change from the one direction toward the other, right? Yeah. And that domain we're working with a lot in this area with mantra and with the sutras is our mind. So there are things in our mind that are painful. There are things in our mind that are motivating and delightful. And how do we create good karmas and good samskaras and good habits and good impressions? Well, we do things that create them. And how do we deal with the ones that are painful? Well, this is a question that comes up, and I was listening to a podcast you had with somebody else. This whole issue of how do we not spiritually bypass, but how do the sutras actually tell us how to deal with this stuff? And so one of the things that I take from this is that when we're in a meditation practice, which is the other thing we can do without in our prison cells,
maybe we'll be mates,
which we don't have to have. Oh, yeah, that'd be fun. Is that what is always with us? Our mind and our breath. And so what are the two objects of attention for our meditation focus? The breath and mantra. And if you read the sutras, it gives you Om, so chanting mantra, and the breath. And those are the two first things you get. Then you get some other things. So in this tradition, it's really aligning the mind with the breath, because the mind's nature is to move, right? So neuroplasticity makes sense. The mind is moving. It's doing new things. It's creating new things. It's remembering new things. Which direction do we take the mind while we're creating new things or deepening old things? Some good things we want to deepen, some bad things we want to not deepen. So while the mind's moving, what do we yoke it to? You know, to use that original understanding of where the yoga comes from. What do we yoke it to? Breath is moving. The mind is moving with words. So we give it words. We give it mantra words. And these mantra words have meaning. They have prana. Both of these are forms of prana, right? Mm-hmm. So we're actually yoking chitta to prana. We're yoking the mind to breath prana and to mantra prana in a repetitive way. Breath is repetitive, mantra is repetitive, where we get in this new cycle, this new samskara cycle, of, if you would, where we're laying down deeper and deeper new tracks that are beloved, words we choose, meanings that we want to cultivate, places we want to energetically be in ourselves. And we're deepening that groove, turning it into a vasana, so that in moments when we need it, it's right there for us. In moments when we come to it, it feels familiar to us. In moments we come to it, it feels trusted and beloved to us. And we want our mind to be a place like that, right? So how do we do that? We keep coming back to it until we've created those conditions. And I think mantra does that so beautifully for us.
Let's take just a moment away from the episode to talk about a brand new program that we have coming at Notre Dame of Maryland School of Integrative Health. In addition to our Masters of Science in Yoga Therapy, we've developed a new certificate program. This certificate program is specifically designed for people who have licensed healthcare practitioner status or have a master's degree in some other field, but you'd love to get a certificate in therapeutic yoga to be able to help your clients in clinical settings, educational settings, and community health and wellness. This program for people who already have LHCP or have a master's degree is a 15-month program. It's one class per semester, and it's a really fantastic, groundbreaking program, unlike any other program I've seen in the nation. I'd love for you to come and check out our LHCP therapeutic yoga program at Notre Dame of Maryland. We have open houses every month, and we can tell you all about it. Or you can email me to get more information. Thanks so much for listening, and back to the episode.
It does it in so many different ways, too. There's the actual words of the mantra and what do they mean? Mm-hmm. And we say them over and over and build this new track in our mind. Mm-hmm. It's vibrational. Mm-hmm. Our actual pranic body is shifted by the vibrations. There's a bhavana, or a visualization, that we have when we're chanting to the sun or the moon or the herbs or, you know, whatever it is that we're laying down that new track, the vitality, the health, the healing, the connection to God. So you've got all these different ways that that new track is getting laid down inside of you.
Yeah, it's multi-layered, just like we are. Right. Yeah. And so every aspect of us, the more, I mean, we talk about when we're all focused with all parts of ourselves, that we are more powerful because we're all in harmony, we're all balanced, we're all aligned, not one part of us pulling this way and one part of us pulling that way. And so when you've got a mantra that has a meaning that you're comfortable with, a rhythm that you can bathe yourself in, there's also the seer of the mantra and the shakti of the mantra and the prana of the mantra and the rhythm that is regulating our autonomic nervous system of the mantra, all of those extra power, extra power, extra power, extra power, extra alignment, which is why it's really important that people, when they're chanting, feel comfortable with the mantra, because otherwise some part of us of them is holding back. Right? You're not getting the full power you might get if you think, yes, I can align myself more fully with this. And then you're getting, just as you said, all those extra layers of engagement with yourself.
What you're saying is reminding me of, I grew up in the Lutheran church because my dad's a pastor. And then in my adulthood, I didn't go very often, I'll admit. I got into yoga and, you know, that was kind of my path. But I went back, I don't know, this was probably 20 years ago. I went back and sat in the church pew on some Easter Sunday. Mm-hmm. And I just started crying because the music, mm-hmm. the cadence, the rhythm, the repetition, what mm-hmm. happened to my nervous system. I knew those songs from 30 yeah. years earlier. They were yeah. embedded in me. You know, whether you're chanting in Sanskrit or Hebrew or Lutheranism, whatever, you know, like yeah. it's in you then. And yeah. that is powerful. And so I love what yeah. you said about, can you get all the layers of your system aligned in one direction, linking positively to that without mm-hmm. resistance? Now, for yeah. me, you know, at that time, I realized, wow, there is something still very positive that I'm linked to in this moment on Easter Sunday. That was kind of like, whoa, this feels amazing and good and lovely. But other people have a real pushback because mm-hmm. they don't like their childhood religion or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. We have different conditions.
Yeah. So do you think that a lot of people who've come to yoga, it's almost like a clean slate when they get to chant the sutras or Arogya mantra, or it's like, okay, I didn't really connect maybe with my childhood religion, but this I can get behind. The meaning, the feeling, it's almost like they have a clean slate. So I'd like to know that, but then like, how did you come to chanting in yoga?
All right, so, two good questions. Yeah. So I want to, three comments. The first one is your experience, right? There's something physical we're doing. And when you do chanting with a mala, this chanting, there's a physical connection. There's like, I'm right here, I'm right here, I'm right here, I'm right here, I'm right here. There's regulation of your nervous system with the rhythm and the breath rate. And it brings in a word I wanted to throw in, which is co-regulation. Here we are all co-regulating. And doesn't that feel nice when we're all co-regulating? We're all doing the same thing. We're having this feeling. We're here together. We're breathing and chanting together. And there is some real power in being in community when you're doing that. Your mind is in a place, your intuition is saying, yes, you're connected to the larger forces. So there's there. When I have encountered in bringing chanting, because I do bring chanting, I think it's really important we keep it alive. It's the original transmission method. I mean, yoga is like everything that's old, oral transmission first, written second. And the way it was passed to me was really oral transmission. And now we know that some people are more oral learners and some people are more visual learners and some people are more what, you know, but oral transmission and the power of speech is really important in the yoga tradition. And so there are rules around it, like, you know, pronouncing it correctly and how you do it, because you don't want to change it. You want to preserve it and you want to pass it on intact. And so there were a lot of guidance around how to do that, but that was how you kept the wisdom alive. And that's what we have to be grateful for, too, is that because people chanted these mantras, they kept them alive across centuries. I think some of this wisdom existed other places in the world, but wasn't kept alive in the same way. And so it's really important and powerful. And one of the things Panditji, my teacher, says to me is, the mantra dies if no one chants it. I mean, it's still there, but it loses its prana, right? And so what we're doing is keeping them alive. We're putting prana into them. And so I've heard teachers talk about how some mantras we're more familiar with because they've been kept alive over the years, where the other ones faded away, but these ones have been preserved and kept alive. And so part of what I do when I do that and pass it on is I'm thinking this duty we have to keep this alive. It was kept alive for us. Our job is to keep it alive too. Right? And so we pass it on. Also know that there are not a lot of places you can go to learn how to chant these mantras with a adequately prepared teacher who's skillful enough and knowledgeable enough to pass it on. And so it's really incumbent on some of us to do that so that we can be places that people can come to do that. And then my experience where this blank slate, I think that's a really good idea. Like people and come with ideas, so it's not completely blank. Like people do come to yoga with ideas about what it's going to be like, but they haven't experienced it themselves, perhaps. And there's all new things that they haven't experienced themselves. Like maybe they've experienced this kind of yoga, but not that kind of yoga, you know? So I think there is this newness, and newness can be both exciting and scary. So I've seen people across the time that I've been doing this where maybe some body you didn't think would resonate to it really does. Somebody you think might not or might didn't. I can't predict. I just don't even predict anymore. So instead of trying to predict and trying to say, oh, I will or won't offer this to that person, I invite, I offer, I say, let's try it out. You know, you can just listen. You don't have to add your voice. You can add your voice. I give lots of choice points so that people can have the experience, because until you've had the experience, you don't know. Right? And if we're always afraid to share, then nobody gets to find out. And then people do encounter things like, oh, this reminds me of church, I don't like it. Or, oh, this is a language I don't know, I don't like it. Or, oh my God, I love that. You know? So we've also got what I think of as the rule of thirds. There are the people who absolutely love it. There's the people who like it, they're kind of okay with it. And the people who move down the alphabet to M and go, meh. You know?
Not worth the trouble.
You know, not yet. But sometimes they come around. So I figure what I'm doing is I'm casting out this net, if you will, and saying, who's in? You know, if you're in, let's do this together, and giving people an opportunity. And I've been surprised and not surprised how many people really take to it when they've had the opportunity to really be exposed to it and understand what it is, how it could be helpful to them.
I think that's just it. I mean, my experience is that the people who become interested in it, they heard some chanting that made them feel a certain way. Yeah. And that internal experience was what made them think, wow, I need to check this out more. So I think that's interesting. You know, the entry doors they can come in through. And I think there's a big difference between memorizing the chant intellectually for perfection versus I'm going to allow the vibration to wash over me, through me. Yeah. And, you know, I just want to say one little thing about this. I was the type that came in for the nervous system washing and for the positive visualization. And like, it felt really good. And my chanting teacher said to me, it's fine if you want to learn these chants from that perspective, but then you don't get to go teach them. She said, if you want to learn to teach them, then we go from a completely different angle, which is get it right. Get your tongue in the right spot. Actually pronounce the words with precision. So I've always remembered that becoming a teacher of it requires a totally different level than, wow, I love this. I've been doing it a long time. So I've never decided to perfect it at that teaching level yet. Whereas I think you have.
Well, yes and no. So this is a conversation I thought we might have, which is we come from the same lineage, but slightly different paths on the same lineage, or different evolutions down that lineage. And I also come from the Himalayan Institute lineage, and that's my primary lineage. So we are taught to learn to pronounce it right, but what's more important is the feeling. And we are taught not to perfect it to teach, but to practice it. And this is where my heart is. So this is where I am. So
maybe I need to come over there. I could fit in.
Come on over. So we really use mantra as meditation. You know, we learn this mantra and that mantra and this mantra and that mantra, and they all build on each other. But their purpose is always for japa, which is silent internal repetition, as a meditation practice. And they have different intentions, and he has them for different ways. But it's very much about learn to pronounce it, that matters. Learn about the mantra, that matters. What matters most is that you practice and you feel it.
If you've had a student, you know, to build these new neural pathways and really kind of lay down this new track, I love that idea that you suggested. Chanting's inherently repetitive. Mm-hmm. But what distinguishes, like, I'm feeling compulsive about this, I have to do 108, versus kind of therapeutic repetition where you are letting the feelings kind of move through you and shift your internal landscape?
Okay, two answers. One, if you want complete feeling and inner landscape, kirtan, which is sing-songy. It's not mantra japa, and it's not teaching lineage. It's the other path, which is kind of kirtan feel, just let yourself be caught up in it. Yeah. But the other thing, what did you say,
like
going back to
repetition versus
repetition. So to keep to this idea of Abhyasa Vairagya, you need some structure, and your structure needs to match where you are, meet the person where they are. So when I teach, I say, you might do this mantra 3 times. That's a magic number. You can do it 3 times. And we do like Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. We say 3 times. We can do Om. We do 3 times. You can do this 3 times. And you can work that into your day. You can use the counting on your fingers and do it 11 times. So there's some mantras that Panditji teaches us. He says, this is an 11 repetition mantra, you know, and you can do that for this period of time. Or if you're going to do, I use these mala beads. I say, if you can't do a whole 108, what you want to do is not be sitting there thinking, when do I quit? When do I stop? I want to quit. I want to stop and stop. You want to keep your commitment. So you go, okay, I'm going to do this bracelet, this many beads, right? So that may be something that you can do. Or if you want to do a mala, decide if you're going to do half and do half. Decide if you're going to do a quarter and do a quarter. Put your other hand where you're going to stop and go until you get there so that you build this commitment to yourself and keeping it. And you acknowledge that you're not maybe all the way there, particularly with longer mantras. That's some time and a lot of repetition. So you build up in this vinyasa krama, wise progression kind of way, knowing that there's steps along the way so that that becomes something that you can do and sustain and enjoy. Then there's also the thing where the mantra just comes to you. So this is, I think, one of the really powerful things where I find myself in a place and all of a sudden the mantra comes to me, like, this is my guide, this is my friend. Sometimes when I'm driving, or, you know, when I was walking to teach and I've been aggravated by something on the train in London, I'm like, I have to teach, and I, you know, move into something. I had a client tell me one time that she was really scared and a mantra came to her and it helped her soothe herself. And so it's that other way that the mantra presents itself also as the thought in your mind, as opposed to, oh my God, I'm really, really scared. What comes instead is this comforting mantra. So one of the nice things about knowing different mantras is, if I am working with somebody who is ready to work with a mantra, what is it that they need? What is the mantra that's right for them? That's just like any other practice where we're trying to know the person well enough to match the practice to them and then give them enough so that they can begin to use it in a productive way. So it's not another tool where they feel like, oh, I can't do this, oh, I didn't do it right, or whatever.
You know, there'd be some kind of co-assessment where you're looking at them and figuring out what's the tempo, what's the volume, what's the tone, what's the meaning of this mantra, how long do they have each morning? You know, like there's so many factors that if you have studied this, you can choose a very precise mantra that's going to work for them at the capacity that they're at, amount of resources they have in terms of, you know, I have 4 kids, I have to get them to school in the morning, it has to be short, you know, this kind of thing.
Yeah, their readiness, their receptivity, what resonates for them, all of those things. And that's where yoga therapy is so beautiful, right? You can offer a group, you're going to have those different responses. I'll give you a story. Just this last Friday, I was teaching a class for students that I know pretty well. And I asked them, anything good for me to know about you today, or you'd like me to sort of work in? And two of them told me head, neck, and shoulder kind of stuff. And I was thinking, okay, I thought, oh, there's a practice that I know that's a mantra kriya practice from a teacher we both know, Ananda Bali Yogi, that's the Nada Shuddhi Brahma Kriya. And I don't know if you know it, but you move your head and you chant A, you move your head ooh, mm, and he. And I knew that one of those people knew it and had practiced it and liked it. The other one didn't know it, but she had recently come to a mantra workshop I had done. So I thought maybe they're receptive. Thought the rest of the people had had some exposure to it. So I did it and they were both like, oh, that was so nice. And then a third person emailed me and she said, this morning before class, I was hoping you would do that one.
Wow.
And I love it when that happens, you know, like she didn't say anything. She wasn't one of the people who spoke up. I haven't done that Kriya practice in a while in that class, but there was something lined up.
Yeah. And you listened.
You listen to the people in front of you, you listen to your inner wisdom.
Yeah, I knew the people and I knew what might work, and fortunately it did.
How do you know how to create this kind of safe, predictable container for people? Is that something you learned from your teachers? Is that something you learned in clinical psychology? Like, I hear you saying that chanting can create an internal state of stability and safety, but I would imagine you're also doing that in your classes too.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most important things we do as yoga teachers, really. I teach a restorative nidra class on a Friday evening. There's certain things that I do and speak to set up the beginning of the class. And this one woman came up to me afterwards and she goes, "Are you a trauma-informed yoga teacher?"
You're like, "Why, yes, I am." Personal trauma-informed.
So I think that it's not as common here. People don't ask as much about injuries. They don't do that as much. There's more activity and more focus on exercise. And, you know, so for me, being me is one of the things where I go, I moved from my comfort zone where being me was, well, I also had to develop that there, but had it. And then to come here where yoga seemed differently and be myself and be different, it definitely been a bit of a challenge. And I'm really grateful that people have let me be me. But I'll have people come up to me and they'll say, "You're not like the other teachers."
Which one of these is
not? And, you know, there's some people who then come because they really like that, and other people, that's not what they want, and that's fine. But I feel like I get to be me.
Right.
And that's what I have to offer. And the more I can do that, the better I am. And so I did a chanting workshop at Christmas for this studio where we don't usually chant. And I had a pretty good turnout. And some of the people on the teacher training came. I didn't know that at the time. But then I wrote back to the woman who's ahead of it and said, "You know, I think they liked it." She goes, "Oh, yeah, they came to me and said they really liked it." But there were people who'd never chanted before and just wanted to see what this thing was.
It's so hard. I think all yoga therapists can relate to this. But chanting teachers are even further down the line. Being on the cutting edge is hard work. So I feel like many yoga teachers and yoga therapists were on the cutting edge for asana and maybe pranayama and a little bit of meditation. But as a chanting teacher, that's an area that's yet to be explored by many, many people. So you're like way out in front, experiencing the new frontier and the new, I don't know, I'm just imagining like a pioneer going across the whole west of part of the United States and their little buggy and all the bumps and people don't get it. It's hard, you know?
There are things that are hard, but isn't this hilarious, Amy, that my new frontier is the old frontier?
Say more about that. Yeah,
old chanting is the original, right? So there's a part where, you know, I think we share this sense of wanting to keep the traditional aspects of practice alive. And we also know they need to grow and adapt. But how do we do that with integrity and also honor creativity, which is, I understand, is the divine in us, right? Manifesting, bringing things into being. So, yeah, I think this was one of the gifts that I was really given. And one of the reasons I really study is I need to be resourced to feel like I can do this. I need to be supported to feel like I can do this. I remember, you weren't there, but a friend of ours was there, Marlisa Sullivan, at a yoga therapy conference in Amsterdam, where Steve Porges and Sue Carter came. And I got to be on a panel with me and Sue on a panel, and Melissa and Stephen were on a panel. And I was doing a talk on the therapeutic relationship, which is what I think what you've asked me about. I really think the therapeutic relationship is important. The space that we hold for people, because yoga practice is vulnerable. Yoga practice is revealing. So many people notice their breath or what they can and can't do, and that critical voice comes in. And I think the more we create a safe place for curiosity and exploration and compassion, the more people can be with themselves in a new way. And so I think this therapeutic relationship and holding is really important. So I was giving a talk on that, and I start almost all my talks with the Shanti mantra, Saha Na Bhavatu. And so I was chanting it. And it was this room full of people, you know, then like my comfort with my own voice and chanting it. And I remember Sue said to me, "You should give up yoga and start singing." And that was the best compliment ever in a funny way, but just like I was so nervous. I was so scared with a microphone doing that, but I was going to do it because then all these people know that this mantra has the attitudes and the conditions we want to create harmony and safety and vitality and clarity among ourselves when we're practicing together.
Yes. You know, you're talking about your discomfort with setting that intention for this big crowd of people. But do you find that when people first start chanting that they oftentimes meet some resistance or discomfort, especially with the sound of their own voice? Like, do we just kind of continue to try and work through that? Because, you know, that's a strong resistance to our own voice.
Well, it's in part why I brought it up, because expression, the throat and expression. For so many of us, this is such an issue now. Do I have a voice? Am I silenced? Can I speak up? There will be resistance to me speaking up. I'm afraid. Chanting is just another in the long list of things that we might be afraid to share that matter to us. And how do we nourish and resource ourselves enough to be able to do this thing that is meaningful and share and say so that we're not silenced or blocked, even though there may be challenge or fear or scare, you know? And so just the sound of our own voice, very much. And the reason I said that is, you know, we're told you can't carry a tune. Early on, when I was in elementary school, I took a music test and they said, maybe not for you, right? So, and I have some hearing loss. So maybe, you know, not hearing sounds or, you know, just even sharing your voice or doing it in a different way. People have different tunes they use. Or, you know, there's all kinds of things that can be obstacles. There's so many things that are always can be obstacles for us. And so it's like anything else. We see the obstacle. That's the place to put our effort in, right? How do we work on that? And that's where some of the vairagya can come in. You know, what can I let go of about the sound of my voice? You know, how can I form a new relationship to the sound of my voice? Maybe I only do this, you know, when I'm on mute on Zoom and nobody can hear me. When I'm doing mantra japa, there's no one else but me in my own mind hearing me. There's no one stopping me, you know. Maybe I can begin to do it. So it is the place where we direct effort, the abhyasa, the place where something needs to change, the vairagya.
You're also reminding me of I used to go down to my chanting teacher all the time. She's in California, so I don't see her anymore, but I would drive down there. And if I was really dysregulated, the lesson would be very hard for me, like to the point where sometimes I just burst out in tears. I can't do this. I'd feel like my head was on fire, smoke coming out of my ears because I was thinking so hard and trying to get it right and perfectionism. So like, I could see in the practice very clearly the mirror to my life, but I wasn't noticing it in my life until I went and sat in front of her. Mm-hmm. And then it was very, very clear. And I remember feeling so much resistance, like, oh my God, it's going to be like a 2-hour lesson. And it's just going to reflect back all my dysregulation and my inability to focus and hear and be present. My mind's going to be jumping around like a little monkey all over the place for the first hour. Like, it was painful.
I'm hearing you. Yeah. I think you need to come over to my team.
I think so too.
Because I've gone with some of your teachers too, because I want to learn that too, be exposed to it too. And I've had this conversation recently. I was assisting Gary Krafsow. He was doing a yoga therapy training in London. I got to go and assist him, which was really lovely. We were having this conversation about the different chanting styles because he knows Pandici as well. On the one hand, I think that our yoga practice, first of all, reveals ourselves to ourselves. Right? That's its first
sure
function.
Did.
That's its first function. So it reveals. And we can see, is it revealing more of this stuff I don't like? Or is it beginning to reveal some of this stuff I do like? Those moments when we start to going, oh, I do like what I'm seeing, you know, it's further down the road of transformation. But in that first part, there's a big obstacle to climb over. There's a lot of not likes, you know, a lot more dvesha than ragas. So I can absolutely see that. Yeah.
I mean, I think the solution for that, in my opinion, is start with much smaller chants, much easier ones, ones that give you that feel good that you can go to when you're dysregulated, you know, instead of trying to learn these big, long 3-page chants.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
A lot good application where I was in my life at that moment. And it was self-driven. I will admit that. Yeah. I want to learn the Shraddha mantra, or I want to learn, you know.
Yeah. That's part of how we also learn. You probably change something as a result of that. You know, and until we see it, we can't change it. So that's the other first step. And something was motivating you. Something motivated you to ask me about it today. You know, there's some love you have for it that you've conveyed today. So I think you're trying to find your place where you get to do the thing that you love.
You know, this is a story I don't tell very often, but I'm going to just make it very brief. I loved chanting the first 10 years. And then I had a teacher really, really disappoint me. And at that moment, all I could hear in any of the chants was that teacher's voice chanting. So I took a 10-year break.
Yeah.
I needed that break. I couldn't do it. And so just talking to you today again just kind of reinforces that, oh, there was a time you loved this, you know?
Yeah. And if you remember with Abhyasa Vairagya, the next sutras are about do it with love, right? Love and devotion, reverence. And so that's an important ingredient to keep us going. And you can see the power of a samskara that blocks us from something that we love or want or could do. And so it needs some digesting, having some of the potency taken out of it by spending some time with it and seeing it. I'm so glad you could share that today and go, ah, you know, you join the points and then you can do something different with it.
So as we come closer to the end, how has your relationship with chanting evolved over the years?
Well, the first time I went to the Himalayan Institute, 2004, Panditji was doing a havan practice, a fire ceremony. We were chanting a mantra, and I had a piece of paper with the mantra on it, and I loved doing it. And that piece of paper sat on my altar for 20-something years. Now it's in a drawer, I think. I moved it somewhere. It's in a file because I remembered it, I chanted it, but then over the time of studying with him, and he would reveal more and more and more and more, I came to know where that mantra came from. I came to know what that mantra was about. I came to share that mantra. And I came to realize more and more about it, that it's like it planted a seed and then it sprouted, 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 sprouted over the years. So it was from the Devi Mahatmam, which we've just had the 9 nights of Navarati, which are the chanting of the Devi Mahatmam, in the time when it's quiet and internal rather than chanted out loud. And it's the mantra where toward the end, after there've been all the demons and all the demons and all the demons and all the demons, which we can think of as all the onslaughts in our mind, the Devi steps in, she solves the problem, the demon's gone, they go back to life. The demons come back, they call her back. So this time they say, hey, if this happens again, because they've learned, can we call on you? And she says, absolutely. Every time you need, you can call on me. I'm always here for you. This is protection against fear. In this mantra, you have all the power, protect us from fear by knowing that you are there for us. So again, that secure base, that reliable anchor, that person you can turn to. And chanted it with some students the other day because one of them said, I'm really anxious and really afraid in this class. And she said, oh my, that felt like just the right thing. So over the years, I've learned new mantras. I've continued to study with Panditji learning mantras. I've continued to practice mantras. I've more freely shared mantras. During the pandemic for 2 years, I think you know this, I had a Facebook group where I chanted mantra twice a week, no matter where I was, no matter what was happening. And people would tune in and chant with me or they would watch the recording. I still think that's one of the single best things I ever did.
Wow. I mean, especially during the pandemic when everyone was cooped up inside and they could get on Zoom and get that stability 2 times a week. Yeah.
The very first person I ever initiated into a mantra told me she woke up at 2 in the morning, went onto Facebook and saw I was chanting and joined in. And she was in Colorado and I was in the Netherlands, or probably in London then. I tend to be somebody who likes a face-to-face relationship more than a virtual one, but there are places where the virtual has a place. And that really felt like in a moment of need, it was there for her. And so that keeps me going, even if it's hard.
Hmm, Well, let's look at your website together. Some people may be watching this on YouTube. Others may be listening on your favorite audio podcast station. But your website, Lisa, is www.lifetreeyoga.com. Very cute picture of you right here. And
there's a plug for the Women's Writers Yoga Therapy book club that we're in.
Yes, wonderful. So tell me this. Tell me, if someone wanted to study with you or to chant with you, you know, this episode, we're probably 3 or 4 months ahead. Yeah. So thinking towards, you know, summer 2026, is there anything on your website that you would point us to?
Not right now. I'm actually finishing. I also, in the pandemic, went back to school. I'm doing a master's in creative writing for therapeutic purposes. And my dissertation is due at the end of March. Wow. After the end of March, this is one of the few things I'm putting extra into my schedule. After the end of March, I have a new lease on life, and I'm going to be scheduling out into the rest of the year. But right now, I am working on my dissertation. But I did 4 chanting workshops last year. I presume I'll do some next year as well. And you could go to recorded classes or classes that I recorded mostly during the pandemic. They're all still there. People are very welcome to go to them and use them if they're helpful. I teach an integrated class, so it's asana, pranayama, relaxation, meditation. And they're 90-minute classes. They're on my YouTube channel. I still teach an online group class on Fridays. People could join that, as well as teaching in person. I do primarily yoga therapy. So I do yoga therapy online and in person here in the Netherlands, but also largely online. So there's definitely ways to contact me. Lisa at lifetreeyoga.com is my email address, so that's kind of simple. That picture was taken at the Himalayan Institute. I remember the shrine is right behind me. I remember that day. It was really nice.
And do you do private yoga therapy sessions online?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's what I was saying. I do online. Bulk of what I do these days is yoga therapy. I also do yoga psychotherapy. So I figure leave none of me out, right? Yeah. So depending upon what the person needs and wants, but I integrate talking and the mental health focus, life focus, spiritual focus, along with our bodies and our energy levels and, you know, kind of more holistic.
I think that's what people want. Everyone I talk to says, I'm so glad this came up, because they say, where can I find someone like that? That's mm-hmm. you know, a clinical psychologist, but also studies deeply in yoga.
And I really think what I've endeavored to do is to study both of them and integrate them. So I'm not one who just pulls in pieces or one who just pulls in pieces. I think both systems have their integrity, but in me, they feel like they're woven.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Lisa, for being here with us today.
So nice.
I'm just feeling like I'm missing you now, because you're living in Europe and me here. I don't know when we'll see each other again, but hopefully at a conference or at some.
I miss the days when we saw each other, Amy.
I know. My heart is hurting a little bit right now. And just to say, I got to stay with Lisa at her house in London and meet her kitties and her husband. And
that was nice. That was a fun trip.
So fun.
We've been in Japan together.
Yes, yes. Well, we just have to find some place in the world to meet again.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on. Sometimes it does feel quiet over here in my little village life. So the book club is a really nice way to reconnect to people that I'm used to seeing in person and really value interacting with. This is another way to be with you. So I always enjoy our conversation. So thank you very much for this opportunity, Amy.
Thank you.
Take care.
Now, as we complete this episode with Lisa Kaylee Isley, again, her website is lifetreeyoga.com. I just want to say how grateful I am to Lisa for holding both the Western medical as well as the deep philosophical traditions of yoga It is so easy to go to one side or the other. When you show up as a Western healthcare practitioner and that's your base and your lens and just throw in a few yoga tools, or on the other side, we have people that are so deeply immersed in yoga, it's very, very hard for them to understand what healthcare needs from us. And Lisa is one of the few people I've met that has made it to this very high level in both fields and is able to integrate them and be the bridge and talk back and forth the language that each team needs to hear in order to come together. I think she's just an invaluable resource for our community. And I hope over time that more of us can learn how to be this bridge because we've gone deeply into both, not because we've chosen one or over the other. So thank you, Lisa. It's been wonderful to be with you today. And I look forward to speaking with our guest next week. Everyone have a great week and do a little bit of chanting if you can.
A way that you can help support the Yoga Therapy Hour. Our Optimal State mobile app is available for both Android and iPhone. We've really simplified the check-in process, and it's a way to track your nervous system regulation, as well as your physical health and mental health. It can be part of your personal or professional practice. And by that, what we mean is that you might like to track your own nervous system, mental and physical health, and see the data for yourself, as well as receive interventions, do yoga nidras, breath work, meditation. All of it is on the app, and new content is being added all the time. But a second way you might like to use it is to recommend that your clients, your students, also use the app so that they can show you the data about their nervous system, about their mental and physical health. You can see where they've been in the weeks or months between the times that you meet with them as a practitioner. The app offers structured practices, self-assessment tools, and it's guided and rooted in yoga therapy and nervous system science. It's designed to help you track your state and begin to understand what shifts you and how to choose practices that will bring you back into balance. Whether you're using it for your own well-being or integrating it into the care for others that you offer, we'd love for you to come check it out and do the 3-week free trial. After that, it's about $5 a month. It's a tool that can support you and also the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. Thanks for listening to this small way that you can support the Yoga Therapy Hour.
We wish you a wonderful week. We hope that somehow, in a small way, we've contributed to your well-being so that you can go out and share that well-being with others. That's what life is all about, bringing in the goodness through you and then shining it out to the world. We need you more than ever. So let's all get out there, do good, be good, and have a great week.